This is Two Dope Boys in a Podcast. I'm Michael Brooks.
I'm Phil McKenzie.
Two Dope Boys is a shout out from the margins. Each week we break down trends using the lens of culture to shed light on what's significant to your future and why. How you doing, Paizan?
Doing great, man.
Another journey. We're here with super producer Matt Leck, creative director Shauna Wan, always with us in spirit. We're riding Dolo this week, and we got to get to the brand F-Up. And the brand F-Up comes to us courtesy of Bill Maher, who I don't know if we have majorly different feelings about. He's a guy I could say as kind of as part of my profile being a comedian. Not totally unfunny. He's been funny at times, but he's also just been kind of a, I don't like the word problematic, but just kind of a dick, particularly about Muslims, I would say, for a very long time. And he's catching a lot of heat for this exchange that he had with Republican Senator Ben Sasse from Nebraska. It's actually led to his first apology that I can remember him ever issuing.
Has he never apologized?
I don't think he's ever apologized. Mm. I mean, he didn't even apologize for what got him fired from his first gig.
The apology virgin.
This is the this was his first. I mean, who knows what he did in this. I mean, maybe he did apologize when he lost his virginity. But this is what Bill Maher, in an exchange from Ben Sasse last week, this is how it went down.
No, okay, adults dress up for Halloween. They don't do that in Nebraska?
It's frowned upon. Yeah, we don't do that quite as much. But
wow. I got to get to Nebraska more.
You're welcome. We'd love to have you work in the fields with us.
Work in the fields?
That's part of that. That's
Senator, I'm a house nigga. No, it's a joke.
So, you know, there it was. It was a, you know, it was a fail. And I say that as someone who doesn't think that, you know, I guess I'm on the side of like anything could conceivably be made to be funny. That's my kind of orientation. But it was just to shoot such an airball for and bring so much into play to shoot that airball. In a moment of like banter, because you don't know where to go when you're interviewing some boring senator, is pretty pathetic. And he caught a lot of flack on Twitter. My old buddy Reza Aslan said something like, I think it was, you know, Bill Maher said something racist. That's a surprise. Said no Muslim ever. I'm paraphrasing. I'll get to the apology in a second, but what do you think, man?
This is an interesting position to be in, because I think I'm a little bit more extreme on the side of I don't think Bill Maher is funny at all.
Right. You so, hate Bill Maher.
Yeah, I strongly dislike Bill Maher. You know, I think, which is interesting because I went through an evolution with Bill Maher. Like when we were in the middle of the Bush years and things were dark and Bush is terrible, because I always want to stress that to make sure that we stop with this revisionist thing about Bush.
That's
so
very important.
Let's just throw in this, the non sequitur, Bush is an asshole.
Yes.
And was a terrible president.
Yes.
That Bill Maher was very refreshing in those moments. You know, like he was one of the few voices. You know, it's hard to think back to these days of, you know, 2004, 2003. This is now ancient history, but the amount and access of media and communication just was not the same. And so having like a Friday night appointment with a guy who was seemingly liberal that was going to talk shit about Bush was just a great way to spend those nights. You know, as I got, you know, we got a little bit away from Bush and the same kind of act continues. I started to realize, like, yo, this dude Bill Maher is just a real asshole. Like, he gets away with saying things under the umbrella of, you already know I'm gonna say things to push buttons, quote unquote. And so that becomes sort of the way he's setting you up and getting you comfortable with any stupid thing that comes out of his mouth. And he also has this other clever thing, clever in quotes, that he and people like Sam Harris do, where they use their atheism as a way of presenting themselves as having a particular logic and reason that other people don't possess. So because they are atheist, they can say things with this critical eye because they're reasonable and logical. And so everything starts to fall under that umbrella, even when they're not talking about religion.
Right.
No, you know, yeah, so it's a very clever thing, again, quote unquote, that he tries to do. As it pertains to this particular remark, you know, this doesn't surprise me at all, because this is what he does. He says asshole things all the time, whether it's about Muslims, whether it's about women. You know, he's like, his exchange with Cornel West was like super disrespectful, in the sense that, you know, when he had Milo on there, he softballs him and they laugh and giggle about, oh, we have so much in common, actually. And then he tries to like take Cornel West to the carpets about, you know, not supporting Hillary Clinton, as if like he's the reason why Hillary Clinton lost the election in some kind of way. Like, he's just an asshole. You know what I mean? Regardless of this, this just is another, you know,
another brick in the wall.
Yeah, of him being a fucking dick.
Bill Maher said, and this was his apology, "Friday nights are always my worst night of sleep because I'm up reflecting on things I should have or shouldn't have said on my live show. Last night was a particularly long night, as I regret the word I used in the banter of a live moment. The word was offensive and I regret saying it. I'm very sorry." It's a good apology by his standards. I mean, I don't know. I'm not trying to, what'd you say, Matt?
The word.
Yeah.
The word.
The word.
The word. Yeah, jeez. That was literally the joke. I don't know. This is weak. It's weak stuff. I actually say, I always quote The Godfather now when I talk about Bill Maher, which is when the Turk said about the Don, he said, "No offense, Tom, but the Don is slipping." So I think, like, offensive, non-offensive, asshole, not asshole, Bill Maher's whole show and shtick, you know, there was a time even recently where I would watch it at times and I'd be like, wow, I can't believe how unbelievably stupid what he just said about Gaza was, but I would still say, like, this guy's an entertainer, he knows how to put a show together, and that's slipping. So that's the brand F up. We gotta get to what's up. So now we gotta get to what's up, and what's up is a new report by our friend Gabriella Mirabelli, who hosts the Up Next podcast. Phil and I were guests on that show. And she also runs something called Anatomy Media. And they just released a new report called The Young and the Brandless, which is all about how millennials discover content and how channels can speak to those millennials. There's a lot of kind of key findings here. It's a really good report. We'll have a link to it on our show notes. Recommend everybody check it out. But here are some of the kind of key findings from it that I wanted us to pick over, because it has a lot to do with a lot of the things that we talk about and our consulting work and everything else. 58% of young millennials, 18 to 26, discover programs through social networks. Platforms are the most common way for young, OTT platforms are the most common way for millennials to watch television content, 71%. Brand awareness of broadcast and OTT networks among millennials, 18 to 26. Young millennials who watch TV primarily on TV sets are on average better than desktop and mobile viewers at connecting broadcast programs and brands to their network brands. Brand recognition results point to an uphill battle for Amazon and Hulu. And there's also positive relationship between touch point ranking and brand awareness. But I just want to start. I mean, I think this stat that 58% of young millennials, and I would say anecdotally older millennials as well, and people in general, this idea that we're discovering things through social networks, I think cannot be stressed enough. Now, still getting discovered through a social network is obviously not a completely organic process, and not something that can be done in a vacuum. But it does point to that, in this case, you know, finding creative outlets and new, you know, television shows to engage with. Millennials are talking to their peers, they're engaging in their networks, and the kind of traditional mechanisms through, you know, big advertising campaigns and everything else is probably going to fall flat.
Yeah, I think when I read through particularly some of the highlighted items in the report, I think it was very well done. It's very extensive, and I agree that it's worth to all the listeners out there to download the full report and go into it in a lot more detail. But I'm left with this idea that, in a way, everything, you know, new is old. In the sense that, you know, people have always, you know, relied on those they trust to be the gateway, so to speak, for things that they should check out.
Right.
You know, when you, and you know, we might think of these things in terms of entertainment, but it's, you know, let's think about one of the more personal things anybody might have to do. You know, maybe you move to a new town, you're looking for a doctor. If you have a friend in town, you ask them like, hey, right, you know, right, you have a good dentist? Like, who's your doctor? Like, this idea that, you know, we're gonna go that far afield from our core network in order to discover things, whether that's something as personal but yet mundane as a doctor, or something that's a little bit more far afield as to like what we should be watching on TV, what we should be listening to, all those kind of things. I think if anything, those networks are going to become more important, because what we've also seen is a lack of trust in institutions. You know, this is something that we've talked about a lot over not just recent shows, but since we've been doing this, that, you know, people do not trust institutions, whether those are political institutions or media institutions. It's one of the reasons why so-called fake news and information can be spread so easily, because it seemingly comes from sources that are, you know, even though they're spreading lies, they're more trustworthy, right, because they're not institutions. They're not the legacy institutions.
I mean, it's interesting. They also do find, and it's related to this, even in these new platforms you're talking about, if you're taking in the, you know, in the sort of news cycle, and I'm quoting now, this is from a globalnewswire.com write-up of this report. Building awareness of the network brand behind the programming is extremely important to both the broadcast and the OTT networks because strong brands are leveraged as a curatorial tool by viewers, which in turn helps build awareness of new programs and facilitates critical program discovery. However, these networks are finding this to be an increasing challenge. So that's interesting. I mean, because you're still saying that basically even in the kind of more networked age, networked exposure to content, the brand behind the content still matters. So HBO still matters for some people. Yeah, HBO still signifies quality for some people.
Maybe, and they cited Netflix as well.
Yeah, Netflix. I think Netflix has obviously done well. And then, you know, they identified specifically Hulu and Amazon as having an uphill climb. And that's interesting, because I think that, you know, you can notice with Amazon and Hulu have had successes, but they're specific. Like, I know you're watching Handmaid's Tale on Hulu,
yeah,
and you're a big fan of that. I know a lot of people that are really enjoying that, but I don't think of that as a Hulu property. I think of that as a popular thing that happens to be on Hulu. And then I think of, you know, Transparent has obviously generated a lot of energy. That's on Amazon. There's a few other things, but I still don't think of those places, and this report reflects that, as, well, this is just on a platform that seems to have their curatorial sense together, so I'll give it a shot. Whereas on, and Netflix, I actually, in my kind of personal experience, is relatively hit or miss as well. But I still think overall Netflix has elevated itself to the point where you go, oh, that's a new thing that Netflix is working on. That's interesting. That might be something worth, you know, watching and engaging with. So it's a new, in some ways it's, you know, the new is same as the old. Networks, peer-to-peer matters most. And then, even though you can't just do it by bludgeoning people with advertising, you have to do it in an entirely different way. But we're still not talking about one-offs. We're still talking about networks and collectives and, you know, large umbrella identities that confer some legitimacy on a product.
And Netflix, you know, it's almost like you could do a whole report just on Netflix, because I think there's a lot of different things about that. I agree with the assessment of those shows that you mentioned, particularly Handmaid's Tale, that, you know, yeah, it's on Hulu. And actually, one of the things I think about as I watch it is like, how the fuck did Hulu get this? Because I never felt the desire to ever use Hulu. I only have it for this show. And the minute right. this is over, I'm done with Hulu.
Wow, you hear you that? You know, Hulu?
Yeah, unless Hulu wants to give me a premium, you know, package for free, then I'll change my mind. But until that happens, I'm kind of like, yeah, I'm not paying $7 for this or $10, whatever it is. Because it's, and that brings me to the other element of like design. Amazon and Hulu are just designed poorly. Like right. if you've ever used right. them,
very poor.
They work very poorly. The discovery on them is not good. The discovery on Netflix is better, though their search is not
no,
that
their
great.
Search
their
is
search
terrible.
Could be yeah. much better than yes. it is. So those are things that actually matter. Like if you're spending your money and you want the ease of watching something that's going to just work and it doesn't work that well, it's automatically going to kind of push you away from it. So, and I think millennials and really any consumer understands that. Like they want that experience. That's this whole experience is built on ease of execution. And the minute it's not easy, why would I want to use it? And Netflix right. has the other benefit of becoming sort of like a verb. This whole idea of Netflix and chill, it's become a thing that's permeated.
You know what has
culture.
Become a thing that some people pointed out to me? Apparently, I don't even remember I say this because I spout so much arrogant shit in my day, but I actually said apparently this came up a couple episodes ago, and I said, I don't do Netflix and chill. I do HBO and go and chill because I'm a little bit more boutique. That's right. You heard it, chalk it, and note it. That's what's up. Check out this report. The Young and the Brandless, Anatomy Media, Gabriella Mirabelli. She's a friend of ours. It's really brilliant, interesting, relevant for anybody working in that space and anybody interested in these wider trends. That's going to be linked to in the show notes. We'll be right back with What's Next.
Now I want to jump to What's Next. And I love when, you know, people in our extended community and friends of ours actually provide us with interesting things that we could highlight on the show. So this story actually comes from a good friend, brother. He's actually spoken at one of our events, our monthly communion events that we do. His name is Tim Hotep, and he sent both myself and Michael a article about a company called Wealth Simple. And they put together a billboard which they placed outside of the Supreme store. And one of the Supreme stores here in New York is on Lafayette Avenue. And they basically put up a billboard that exists outside across the street from the store. And it says 1 cop, 2 flip, 3 invest with the wealthsimple.com underneath it. And to those uninitiated, and also, if you're not looking at this and you're familiar with the Supreme logo, the branding of each of those words, cop, flip, and invest, is very reminiscent of how the Supreme branding looks. So if you're there at the store, this would definitely catch your attention if you're there. So from a branding perspective, I think they did a really good job. And then I was intrigued and I was like, well, what the fuck is Wealth Simple? And basically what they've done is they're an investment company that wants to basically make the idea of investing simple. So I'm going to put aside my personal thoughts and ideas and opinions about mainstream Wall Street. The one thing I will say about what I've looked at, what these guys do, and I think it would be interesting to talk to them, is that they've actually simplified the idea of investment. So a brief editorial, just so we get a backdrop for who these guys are. They basically do index investing in index, what are called index funds or ETFs, exchange traded funds, to keep the cost down for investing. So a lot of hedge funds, which are basically full of shit, charge wealthy people and institutions a lot of money to invest with them under the pretext of them knowing some magical formulas that other people don't know. If you do any sort of research into investing, you'll find out like what are called like passive investment funds, meaning things that just dump a bunch of money into a bucket of stocks and other investments, actually outperform hedge funds. So Wealth Simple is basically replicating that model for a newer audience, in the sense that it's very mobile driven, it's very cheap, very research based. And so that's basically a snapshot of who these guys are. Why this is important as it pertains to Supreme is that they saw an opportunity, which I thought was pretty cool, in the sense that they literally looked outside their window, saw all of these people lined up every Thursday because that's where what are called drops, new drops come out right. that you want to literally cop, which means for those who are uninitiated, to acquire or purchase.
You hear that, Matt?
Having a little vernacular language training here as we go through this.
So Matt was like, and then show me how to do the pound hug again.
That lessens every other Thursday. So that's what these, that's what, so the fact that these guys identified this audience and spoke to them in a fairly authentic way about how to take basically your resale philosophy, which is a big part of this, how the Supreme brand grows. They have limited editions, people go and get them and then resell them for thousands of dollars on the market, and these things have a long history and so on and so forth. So their whole idea is that while you're doing this and you're totally engaged in kind of street culture and hypewear culture, you can take the money that you're making from this and actually invest it into your future. And if you're going to do that, it's best for you to invest it with a company like ours that keep the fees down. We're here to kind of serve you and speak to you authentically and blah, 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 blah. And I thought that this was a perfect kind of branded message. You know, you found a way to fit your world, which might not necessarily coincide with the world of the people who are buying Supremes, and get them to see like, yo, this is maybe something we should look at. And they went deeper into the idea of how fast Supreme is growing. And we've talked a lot about on the show about the failure of retail. You know, just last week there was a report that I saw that over 1,000 retail stores closed across the country just in 1 week, and this is accelerating. And Supreme is one of those brands that's actually growing. You know, they're finding a way to grow, and it's a nice way that all of this kind of, I think, came together in an interesting kind of perspective.
Yeah, I agree very much. So I think it's very astute to take a category that, you know, is never going to be as sexy, basically. Like, you know, financial services are not going to be as sexy as Supreme, right? Like what you're looking like, the fashion choices you're making. Clearly, your financial life is incredibly important. And I think the other aspect for talking to younger people is that, you know, you have a whole industry that is, again, even setting aside the corruption and the dysfunction, is also built and managed on, you know, selling services to people with significant income, which has been, you know, structurally blocked from flowing in any way equally into a millennial market. So there's this whole challenge of like, you know, if you destroy the middle class, then you're not going to have middle class financial services products. So those are kind of like the two structural, you know, there's a brand challenge and then there's a structural challenge. But I think what's very smart about this is finding like an appropriate alliance story to build your service around. And they tracked exactly like how what they do fits in with Supreme, how what they do, you know, fits in with really, you know, a certain set of buying practices, appetites, style choices, and they actually made it work. Because that's, you know, the other part is that it's, you know, this isn't just, you know, the classic kind of baby boomer mode is like, how do you make financial services interesting? Well, you know, you get the Rolling Stones to headline a show for you or something, or, you know, how many ads for lame products have had great songs. But this actually specifically told the story in a way that's specifically related to Supreme, which is why, I mean, first and foremost, it's just an incredibly successful piece of branding and advertising, and in some ways actually a user experience, because it's kind of already bringing people into that mode just in the billboard.
Yeah, and financial services is one of those businesses that, you know, I would offer needs to understand better the world of culture and culture and language.
Definitely.
And these guys, you know, Wealthsimple, have shown at the very least an understanding of the the language that the language of the people you're trying to reach. And what's interesting, I thought about another company, Uber. And Uber, for their radio spots, when they, and I think they've had some on-air like TV commercials that use the same language, they talk about, you know, everybody has a side hustle, you know. And but when you juxtapose the use of that language with the predatory nature of Uber, every time I hear it, it comes off in a way that kind of grates, it grates on me, you know, because I think that, you know, there are lots of people who are Uber drivers who they're doing this because they don't have any choice. Like, right. The economy has made it such that what Uber is trying to make it make light of, like, oh, get your side hustle on, is actually an act for some people. I'm painting with the broad brush here. Obviously, not every person who's an Uber driver or a Lyft driver, for that matter, is desperately seeking income. Some people are what they describe as a side hustle, but many of them are driving under duress, like they're faced with a very serious challenge.
And even a side hustle, I mean, you know, I don't, again, I totally agree that there's a difference between desperately needing to do something and saying like, ooh, I could add a little bit to my income. But I mean, you know, I met my Lyft driver in this case on the way back from Sustainable Brands while I was leaving Detroit. You know, she was a full-time public school teacher. And they haven't gotten a raise since, I think she said, 2008. And, you know, presumably, I didn't read into her finances, but maybe relatively speaking, she could make it work, maybe, without having to do it. But I'm just saying, even the kind of like, it's your choice, it isn't just like dead-ass necessity, still says a lot. Yeah. It says a lot that you need to get into that kind of economy if you want to like take your kids to Disney World once a year too.
Exactly.
If you're already working full time.
And that's the key thing. Like, the side hustle in the way that Uber has used it in branding seems like a fun kind of thing to do.
And it is anything but.
And it's anything but. And right. When they in the Wealth Simple advertising, I mean, they have a longer report that's attached to it, they are speaking to the passion that exist within streetwear culture, that people are enthusiasts in this world, and they're plugging into that idea that you're going to be lined up, you're expert in this. Like, this is not something that you could just casually decide to stroll up, because you wouldn't know what to buy, you don't know the market. Like, there's a whole world to it, and the fact that they recognize and they speak to that audience from a place of respect. They don't patronize. You know, I really am focused on the language and how we communicate with things. And overall, you know, I think maybe these guys would make interesting to kind of bring in. Maybe we have like Wealth Simple and Supreme come in and talk a little bit. They might not even know each other. Maybe they know each other now. But, you know, people are identifying, I think financial services is identifying specifically these ideas that there are cultures out there and there's subcultures out there, and these are opportunities to be a part of these conversations rather than to exploit. And I'm glad you mentioned Detroit, because that was the whole point of our talk, you know, right. How to be an amplifier of culture rather than a gentrifier or a predator. And I think their business is based on trying not to be predatory in a business that is sometimes predatory, but not to be predatory to this particular audience.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And that's why it was a success. And that's why hopefully more successes are what's next. We got to get to the crates. So now we got to get to the crates. These are our picks from culture that make your life better in every way, shape, and form. And I want to pick a really disturbing, really fucked up movie from 1985 called Brazil. Which is a science fiction film. It was directed by Terry Gilliam. And it takes place in a dystopic future. It's a kind of government that is like 1984, but it's more, in a weird way, goofy, although incredibly evil and disturbing, but not as kind of austere. And there's a lot of breakdown of machinery, And it sort of basically alternates between you know, the kind of like main sources of action. The world is ruled by the Ministry of Information, and the main sources of action basically that people can participate in are buying things or terrorism. And there's a lot. Yeah, right. Exactly. So I'll just kind of leave it there. It's a very disturbing. De Niro is not the main character, but he's a great role in it. It's a great De Niro performance. There's a lot in this genre. And I mean, you know, Children of Men is great. A lot of people have talked about Children of Men. Recommend that always. And, you know, I know people are rereading a lot of the kind of classics. I think we've have, you know, Brave New World in consumption, maybe 1984 in politics. But Brazil is a bizarre and unsettling, and in some ways the stupidity and the grossness of it track with our Donald Trump time. So Brazil, Terry Gilliam.
I got one quick one, and it comes from the world of music. There's an artist, he's a UK artist who sadly had a very short career. He died in 1994. He only released one album. His name is Ephraim Lewis, and he died in 1994. The album was released in 1992. The album is called Skin. I'm sure you can listen to the tracks on YouTube. I actually do have a copy. I remember buying this from The Wiz that was across the street from Howard Towers, where I used to live when I was in college. And I didn't know the artist. I wasn't familiar with him at all. You know, it was one of those literally judging a book or a CD by its cover, where it just looked intriguing and I picked it up and instantly fell in love with it. It's kind of neo-soul R&B before those were terms. And it's a shame that he had such a short career. There's not a bad track on the record. You know, a sad case of an artist that left us too early. Would have been great to see what he could have done in the future. But again, if you're digging for some really amazing music that's kind of a predecessor to what would kind of have a neo soul kind of sound, I definitely recommend the album. And again, his name is Ephraim Lewis. The album is called Skin, released in 1992.
Dope. All right, that's another journey. Thank you, brother. Thank you, super producer Matt Leck. You know all the places you can find us. We're back Thursday with On Point.